I'm Adele Ferguson, the Melbourne Press Club's president, and this is the MPC Events podcast. Here, as the name suggests, we're bringing you the best of our monthly speaker events, but in podcast form. Take a listen to this month's episode.
I'd like to congratulate the press, by the way, particularly Adele, on the initial exposures and the arguing for setting up a commission. They have done a great job. There's a similar thing with 7-Eleven. She kept saying, there's a lot more here that we've only been able to hit the top of the iceberg. If you dig in, you'll find millions of cases and so on. Everyone was in denial, but it proved to be true. And I'd also like to congratulate the whistleblowers who, at great cost to themselves, with great courage, have come forward and enabled the exposures in the media to occur. Now, as far as the commission is concerned, its focus was on misconduct, slightly narrow focus in some respect, misconduct and its remedies. It was a bit of a lawyer's exercise with the strengths and weaknesses of that. And there was a powerful exposure of misconduct, far more powerful than you'd get in kind of economic inquiries. It's really changed the world's view of the sector. And there was unqualified, powerful condemnation of the bad behaviour. The Royal Commission was not so good on the whole process of dealing with the difficult policy problems. A lot of them require much more thought, attention, time, consideration. Just to illustrate one, look at the current issues about mortgage brokers. That is a difficult issue. It's not one that was solved. It was a slightly, in a way, superficial recommendation by Hain, maybe the best he could do in the circumstances given the process. But a thing like that, it's already falling apart. It needed to be probed much more deeply, and it will have to be probed much more deeply. And by the way, I think the government's response was to handball it on till 3 years off, if I remember, as to what should really be done about that. So it was, and as you know, the main two remedies proposed were better enforcement, we can talk about that, and better bank culture, and we can talk about that, plus some proposed changes in legislation, particularly the removal of exemptions here and there, which I thought was good. And by the way, Ian just mentioned, you know, that people have been calling for things for years and nothing happened. And in a way, Hain, the whole change of atmosphere has made them easy to go through now, whereas we've found it difficult for many years to get those sorts of changes. But then I would still say I thought the banks got off lightly. I thought he didn't get deeply enough into a number of important things. Structural breakup, separation of the bank's selling activities from their production of products. I thought that was almost certainly wrong, but certainly needed a much deeper look than he gave it. I don't think he's got to the bottom of the questions about how you remunerate people in this sector. There are some things that have been done, hasn't got to the bottom of it. It's a complex matter. Remediation, making up all the underpayments and so on, I don't think he's come up with anything much there myself. I was a bit disappointed with the recommendation. The one, you know, the radical exposure and then the quite limited recommendation. And a lot of the recommendations were really aimed at smaller fry mortgage brokers, commission agents. The big banks got off. There are a few sacrifices. There have been a chairman and a CEO have been offered up as sacrifice and scapegoats. One thing which, this is a little bit early to give a definitive response to the commission, so I'll be very interested to see how the 24 cases go. We can talk about that. If, you know, there are 24 jailings, that would change my view of the impact of the Royal Commission. There's got to be a lot of policy work to follow on from Hayne now, because he just opened up issues without solving them. And I am worried about the policy capacity of the government and politicians and the bankers to deal with these questions. But generally, I thought a bit of a mismatch between the drama, the exposure of the hearings, and the slightly limited recommendations.
Okay, Adil, you've probably worked more intensively than just about any journalist in Australia on this, in this field over the last few years, and produced some stories which were, you know, instrumental in driving change. When it got to the Royal Commission, were you surprised, even despite your experience, about what some of the things that came out, the extent of things that were exposed, or and then indeed, what's your take on how Hayne dealt with all that?
I was actually surprised at some of the things that came out. You know, I'd always known that it wasn't just a few bad apples. That's what the banks had been saying for many years. But I was surprised at the, you know, really the industrialised theft that was going on of people's money. That really shocked me. I was also really shocked by the ineffectiveness of the prudential regulator, APRA. I had always written about ASIC and how incompetent it was and how it was really captive to the big banks. And we hadn't really, you know, I used to joke about APRA every time you'd ring up the PR, he'd say, you know, I can't comment. So I used to joke saying, if you ever want to have a cushy job, become the PR at APRA, because they do nothing all day. And they'll just remind you to go to a speech that Wayne Byers had given, and won't tell you where, so you have to sort of crawl around and try and find it. So that really did shock me at just how off the charts they were in terms of superannuation. And, you know, fees for no service, they were totally missing in action. That did really shock me. And we knew that ASIC was doing a lot of deals behind the scenes in terms of press releases, but when you actually hear it, what is actually going on, that did really shock me in terms of life insurance. You know, I had done the expose with Four Corners on CommInsure, which showed that there was, thanks to a whistleblower who'd come forward, and it had showed that they were doing some really terrible things with, you know, heart attack definitions, etc., where they weren't updating them, so you could never claim. But then when you see that ASIC then does an investigation, almost gives them a clean bill of health, and then a few days before Christmas, they put out a press release that just says that they're going to have a $300,000 community benefit payment. And then you find, when you look at what the Royal Commission goes through it, that they were actually took out significant wording, such as misconduct or deceptive and misleading advertising. That's what they had negotiated. And you think, this is the regulator. And Commissioner Hayne actually said, can I just get this straight? This is the regulator being dictated by the regulated. You know, which is shocking when you think about it. And so getting to your question about, so how did the Royal Commission, how did I feel with the final report? I thought the Royal Commission was fantastic because it put the spotlight on a sector that really needed to be looked at, badly needed to be looked at. You know, Senate inquiries had done a great job. You know, Mark Bishop, who is in the audience, had chaired a parliamentary inquiry and called for a Royal Commission into Combank and ASIC because they didn't have the tools to dig deep enough. So they needed something more. They needed a Royal Commission. And we got that, and it put the spotlight on. But the final report, honestly was a disappointment to me because it didn't get to the guts of the problems. You know, Commissioner Hayne had talked about greed and he really didn't tackle remuneration by the head. He didn't tackle the conflicts of interest which vertical integration has caused. He just stood on the precipice and then backed away. And there are many other things like that that he did, which was a real missed opportunity, I think. And now we're up to politicians, and you know, as you were saying, it's a bidding war about who will do the job.
Ian, on this question, and Alan raised the question of jail terms, but in terms of pursuing you know, quite serious offences that have been revealed, you've been quite outspoken in the past, I think, in relation to ASIC in terms of their preference to do sort of more generalised penalties rather than prosecuting. Is there a change of foot, or do you think we're going to see more of the same in relation to these issues?
So I think there is change afoot, but as Commissioner Hayne says in the report, if after several years things don't change at ASIC, then what's required is to take away from ASIC some of its major enforcement capabilities. At the moment on criminal prosecutions, as we know, they go across to the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions, but that still leaves a huge amount of enforcement that stays with ASIC. So look, I think one of the telling issues coming out of the Commission was ASIC enforcement. There's reference in the final report, and I think it's quite a telling reference to ineffective enforcement culture at ASIC. I was just mentioning to a couple of people at the table here before we came up for the discussion. Before the Royal Commission started, we did a study of 5 years in all enforcement of ASIC over 5 years. And it was absolutely extraordinary to see what it found. In some areas, such as insider trading, where ASIC can choose to take civil action or criminal action, 92% of the time it goes criminal. So in that part of ASIC, there's a view that market integrity, protecting the markets, is important. Insider trading shouldn't be permitted. Even if you make a trivial sum of money, we will prosecute you. You go to the much bigger, let me suggest, much more important area of financial services, the world is different. Our research showed that over 5 years, criminal prosecution is trivial, running at a little over 10%. Of all enforcement action, and often that criminal enforcement action is what I would call soft enforcement. So what's the rest? The rest are banning orders to take people out of the business, which of course are very important to take wrongdoers out of the industry. But as Commissioner Hayne says, that's only part of enforcement. The community cannot expect that a banning order or even forcing someone to pay some compensation is the right thing. You need to ensure that they adhere to the law through proper and strong enforcement action. And of course, so you have then negotiated outcomes that include agreements to be banned for a certain period of time where the alleged wrongdoer says, okay, I'll just not be in the business for 6 months or a year. You have what we call infringement notices that are trivial fines typically with no admission of liability, and you have an incredible growth. The trajectory is like this of what we call enforceable undertakings. What are enforceable undertakings? They are typically agreements between the regulator and the alleged wrongdoer to do what? To comply with the law and quite often to improve compliance. Commissioner Hayne says, what use are these when there's no admission of liability? Because too often they're treated as a cost of business. And we saw case study after case study where the enforcement officer at ASIC had started with the first question being, can we negotiate an outcome that will be acceptable to the alleged wrongdoer? Now, I have to say, that cannot... Not me saying it, Commissioner Hayne said it, but plenty of others. I mean, that cannot be the starting point for a regulator. Can we negotiate something that is acceptable to the alleged wrongdoer with no admission of liability? And then you end up with an argument that the regulator has captured. So will we see change? Well, they've set up a separate office of enforcement. We've seen a deputy commissioner appointed specifically for enforcement. We've seen the Commonwealth government say that it will presumably set up a criminal division of the federal court. At the moment, the federal court can only hear civil cases. We've seen, finally, after decades, higher penalties imposed after some negotiation between the government and the opposition, significantly higher penalties. Will it change? Well, ASIC issued a media release, I think it was 19 February, saying our enforcement action generally across the board is up, investigations is up 15%. Our investigations against large financial firms and their subsidiaries are up 50%. So that's an encouraging start. One other very quick observation, I'm probably taking too much on this, but enforcement is something that I've worked in for decades, actually. We remember that extraordinary hearing where the head of financial advice at AMP was questioned, how many times has AMP lied to the regulator? You may remember it. Well, we got to 10, I've kind of lost count. We're up to 12, we're up to 15, we got over 20, and it was just embarrassing for a senior executive at AMP to realise and to basically have disclosed that there was a serious problem, that senior executives had a policy of lying to the regulator. Well, let me leave you with this question. Why does one of the major financial firms in the country have such an attitude? Is it possibly because of a lack of respect for the regulator? That in other words, you sit around and you think, well, it might be easier just to sort of fudge it with the regulator. What will happen? Well, maybe there'll be an agreement that I shouldn't lie anymore. Well, if that's the case, then things certainly have to change. But
yes, thank you. We'll move to the questions from the floor very quickly, but I'd just like to ask one more question, perhaps to Alan in the first instance, but perhaps a bit of a devil's advocate question here, but there seems to be some signs that the measures that have flown, what's come out of the Royal Commission and some of the measures that are in prospect and in train as a response of that are already leading to a situation where within the banks themselves, there's a great, perhaps a bit of timidity. They're closing in ranks a bit, taking a far more cautious approach to lending, for example. Is there a danger that this could complicate the overall picture that credit is tightening fast in Australia, for example?
I would have thought that if that were to happen, it's just a matter of slightly easing monetary policy, slightly easing interest rates. There are many determinants of the strength of lending, and if there were some tightening up there, then monetary policy can adjust to it. Indeed, I think we're already picking up some signs of that from the Reserve Bank. So I discount that line of argument. I can't stop myself adding a couple of comments on enforcement. And I'll put to one side Adele's very good comment about APRA. We'll do them a bit later if you like. And with Ian, he's covered ASIC pretty well, and I generally endorse it. So I'm from the ACCC background, which is a pretty serious enforcement body. And for 20 years or more, I've been watching ASIC, and it wasn't a serious enforcement body, and it broke the number one rule, which is that Parliament has enacted a law and it said you'll be punished if you break it. Therefore, the role of the regulator is principally to take them to court and get them punished. That's what Parliament wants. And they haven't had that simple attitude to law enforcement. And with regard to the EU's, the enforceable undertakings, they were introduced by the ACCC in my time. We got them through Parliament. Originally, they were there to deal with mergers. There are a number of mergers that were broadly okay, but there are some details were unacceptable, and our only option was to block the whole merger. And so the enforceable intake was a method where you could let a merger through and then get an undertaking. Then it spread through the ACCC, I say with some unease, to picking up actual sanctions and so on. As has been pointed out, but I just want to emphasise it to this audience who doesn't live with it daily, you can only get an enforceable undertaking if the other party agrees. And that's obviously what was worrying the people at ASIC. But you shouldn't be worrying about it. You should be saying to the firm, you're off to court anyway. Also, the point that was touched on about a separation of the function at ASIC, I think that issue needs further pursuit. because it has got mixed up with a whole lot of other jobs that ASIC does, and I think that's compromised. Now, I like an agency whose sole job is law enforcement and nothing else. Before I get started on this topic, I've got to catch a plane tonight.
We all need to go home, Alan.
Yes. Sorry. Just one other thing, just another side of this. I just want to mention the other side of it. Obviously, it's not going to be that easy for ASIC to win cases. It's always been a much harder slog than at the ACCC. Our case has always been a little bit easier to win in the end. ASIC, it's a tougher law. I also think that Judge Hain went a little bit soft on one point in blaming the regulator. He didn't mention the courts have made it pretty hard going and tough and set up a lot of legalistic hurdles to get results. And that's one of the problems that ASIC has had in court. And the ACCC's had it from time to time. I think these cases that have been referred, they'll take a long time to play out. And I just don't know how well they'll go. They'll be resisted. And it might be quite some time before we reach a bit. But I'm a bit cautious about... I'm sure ASIC will run a lot of cases... now, but how well they'll go, well, we'll be back here in 5 years and see. They'll take that long.
Okay. Adil, could I just quickly ask you, I mean, the odds are we're very soon going to have a Labor government. How do you assess Labor's response to the Royal Commission and what they're pledging to do?
I think it's been a lot more positive than the Coalition's in terms of remediation. So they have really gone way further than what the Coalition has. They're not just calling for a compensation scheme of last resort, which was a recommendation in Hain, but they're calling for a $640 million fund, and they want to increase the caps that victims can go and claim. They want to wind it back, you know. So, and they're calling for a lot more financial counsellors and lawyers to help victims who don't, frankly, have the money. Most of them don't have the money in order to battle the banks or, you know, hire expensive lawyers. So, you know, this whole thing with the Royal Commission was really brought about because people were done over. And the Hain report really missed the whole remediation thing. It totally squibbed on that. But Labor actually have come forward and have been rolling out different plans.
Good. Okay, well, we should move to the floor, and if we have any questions... David and Anna have roving microphones. If you've got a question, please grab a mic and identify yourself.
Hi, it's Catherine Tay from Future Eye. I was keen on knowing what you thought were the ways that a board, a bank board, might tell whether the organisational health of these banks was effectively capable of changing and whether it would change.
I'm far from convinced. I'm sure there will be a short-term response, yes. They're going to toughen up, tighten up in all sorts of ways. In the end, however, there's a fundamental problem. Their job is to maximise profit, and they're under pressure from shareholders to maximise profit. I am not terribly confident of the culture of bank boards to really support things in more than a tokenistic way. I think it was interesting that Hain, right at the beginning of the final report, he above all placed the blame, the emphasis, the responsibility on boards and top management. But the report doesn't really do very much about them. As I said, if there were 24 of them strung up, that would change my view. I don't think it will be happening that way on such a scale. So my worry is medium term, the impact of the commission, the Royal Commission, will kind of start to fade away. There's not enough there to get the really deep continuing action. The other little point I'd make is the financial services sector is an incredibly powerful lobby. It's captured politicians and the top departments of government also. They see the world that way, and so they will keep coming back and back and be listened to. Ian mentioned a whole lot of kind of sensible laws that should have gone through, higher sanctions and so on. Unthinkable politically. It's just now we've had an opportunity, the climate's changing, suddenly all these things we just dreamt of are sailing through. I think Haynes should have made more use of the climate that he created to get bigger change while there's the opportunity.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, the power of that report was just naming Ken Henry and Andrew Thorburn in a couple of paragraphs. Look at what the impact was. You know, so a few more names would have been really sent a very clear message to boards. And I think that's the way that we get change, through scaring them, quite frankly.
So just before I touch on a few issues of governance, Alan mentioned the influence of the financial sector or the financial services lobby. I must say, I think that is absolutely true, and we've paid a price for that. When we think about the issue of grandfathering commissions, in other words, commissions that were banned going forward in 2012 because they are what the Commissioner Hayne and others call conflicted remuneration. You look back on the debate on that, and it shows incredibly effective and powerful lobbying, and there's just case after case where I think, to be absolutely frank with you, the community has been ill-served by some of the lobbying. Now, interestingly, we see that in the Hayne report where, for example, he actually says, the current CEO of Commonwealth Bank acknowledged that the lobbying by that institution to support the grandfathering commissions was a mistake. So at least we see some modest kind of acknowledgement. But of course the lobbying continues right now, where at least one financial association talks about the ideological determination of Commissioner Hayne to abolish conflicted remuneration. But I did want to touch on, the question was about governance. So, look, I think that the report actually raises a host of big questions for governance in complex organisations, not just financial organisations. To a large degree, these questions were asked, of course, by the APRA commissioned report when the debacle over CBA was unfolding and the APRA commissioned that report that talked, I mean, really just on page one, about a sense of complacency at the highest levels of CBA. But coming back just a moment or two more on CBA, one of the case studies, and it shows that CBA is worth focusing upon, because it had what you would call a sort of a blue chip board. I mean, people who on paper really ticked the boxes in terms of experience and credentials. And so Commissioner Hayne looks at the 2016 remuneration report, where the board was already on notice of endemic problems, anti-money laundering problems that, of course, turned out to be a huge issue, compliance with counter-terrorism finance. The bank had profound problems. APRA had already raised issues of risk management, mis-selling of credit card insurance, health issues. So the board's on notice of profound problems. The board then considers remuneration for that year. The risk management office says there's no problem here. There's absolutely no problem. And the board signs off on everyone, no one getting a deduction on their variable remuneration based on risk. And of course, the current chair of the board then goes before the commissioner and says that was grossly inadequate. It's kind of an insight into, I think, even how a kind of a, what we might call a high-powered board just failed profoundly on really important governance issues and big questions then for others. The fact that the audit committee of CBA for at least 3 or 4 years had a red, the internal audit raised a red flag on counter-terrorism and anti-money laundering. You know, such a big issue for our financial institutions. The audit committee, again comprised of I think, you know, well-meaning and well-credentialed people, did not at all call for the report. So for 3 or 4 years, it's red flagged as the highest risked issue. And the audit committee, not one member calls for the report or actually questions management when management says, we're dealing with it. Don't you guys worry about it. It's under control. There is a real issue, I think, for non-executive directors as to whether they're devoting enough time, whether they've got the right relationship, whether they've got more of a subservient relationship to management. I think the report's a kind of a big wake-up call combined with the earlier APRA commissioned report on whether well-meaning, well-credentialed, part-time directors are actually doing enough. And if they're not, they need to reconsider, I think, some of their obligations and commitments.
But these presumably are not issues confined to the banks, I would have thought. This is issues for all very large companies. To what extent is there a disconnect between boards and management on critical issues? Any further questions from the floor? One over here. Kilpington Grammar, our esteemed sponsors.
Hi, I'm Paige from Kilpington Grammar, and my question is for the panel. So given the loss of trust now in the system, what advice would you give to young people in reference to how they rebuild this trust?
I think you're absolutely right. Trust has been breached, and I think it's put everyone on notice not to take what they read at face value, but to start asking questions. You know, just because a bank will apologise, it doesn't mean that that flows down to the documentation that they're asking you to sign. So I think in order to rebuild trust, you've got to have confidence yourself that what you're reading is actually correct and do your research.
This is quite difficult to answer in a satisfactory way. It is difficult to, you know, come up with an answer that would change the situation, but I guess young people, in looking at which bank or financial institution they go with, should, as best they can, judge them not only on the offer they make, but on their reputation for probity.
Okay. Any further questions? Sorry. David, for David.
Thanks, panel. David Polton from Inter-Ellison. The answer to this question, this kind of question, is I think usually Scandinavia. But I wondered if you could perhaps maybe Ian could comment on, is there somewhere else that's doing this better? And can we learn lessons from any other overseas jurisdictions about the way in which the financial services sector is regulated and enforced?
Let me offer a quick view. I'd be fascinated to know Adele and Alan's view on this. My sense is if you replicated this Royal Commission in any similar sort of roughly placed country, you'd have the same. And you might think, well, surely that can't be right. I mean, surely these problems are unique to Australia. Wells Fargo. I mean, that's just to scratch the surface.
The
culture of mis-selling. The billions of dollars in fines that have been paid by major financial institutions across the world. It is, I think, a real problem with financial institutions who are essential for the economy and, of course, in large respects have done innovative things and helped as part of raising standards of living around the world. But at the same time, you can point to really good things that this industry has done. You can point to the way in which, because of misconduct by parts of the industry, I think generally, society has suffered. So I think if you replicated the commission elsewhere, you would get similar misconduct found. But I'd be interested to know views of my panellists on that.
I completely agree with you. And, you know, there's been surveys done on other countries, such as the US and the UK and various European countries have big fines. And it hasn't deterred poor behaviour. So it's a question then, what do we do? How do we get this breach of trust back? Because you're absolutely right, it is a global phenomenon and it's been driven by greed. So there has to be, you know, fines do something, but they don't stop poor behaviour.
I think I heard Alan proposing capital punishment a moment ago.
At least torture and capital punishment.
Jail time, so, I think.
So I agree with Ian's point that it would be the same in other countries. I just want to mention another point that there's been more debate and in some cases action in other countries about these structural questions. More about the separation of traditional deposit-taking activities from all the other activities.
We didn't even get
to the vertical integration problem, let alone questions being debated quite widely in other countries about the fact that banks have this special thing, prudential backup if they go wrong, and that's meant to apply just to deposit taking. But then they get into risky trading, investment, life insurance, financial, etc. And if they go bung there, there's some chance there would be a rescue on prudential grounds. So this big question had never been discussed in Australia, but in the US they originally had Glass-Steagall, then that went and Volcker came back with something. The UK's had the Vickers report getting bigger ring fencing. So we haven't got into a serious debate on that, and that's because of the power of the financial lobby.
Yeah, and just one thing in terms of the vertical integration, where, you know, you've got institutions that are cross-selling. And ASIC released a report in January 2018 where it actually looked at vertical integration. It looked at the big four banks and AMP to see what has happened post the future of financial advice reforms, which banned commissions, but you still had vertical integration. And what it found is post that, right now, there was 75% of advice. They looked at files and found 75% of them were still getting inappropriate advice, meaning that you really need to tackle that vertically integrated model if you want to stop these conflicts.
I think we have another question here. Yeah.
Thanks. Johan. Johan Dudberg, Monash University. Thanks for the panel. Really interesting. Just a very brief observation and then a question. I think just to back up with Alan, where Alan started about a big gong to Adele and colleagues for not only being part of the this Royal Commission or it happening, but we also need to acknowledge that one of the other big trust commissions, the Royal Commission into Institutional Child Abuse, was also partly, you know, thanks to reporting. So I think that's quite ironic when we talk about transgressions by the media compared to what the media does sometimes. What's been done in banking and by the Catholic Church is really nothing, to be honest. To me, the elephant in the room is culture and culture change. So, and it's probably because it's the hardest one to address. So I think there is an over-belief in using the law to cause this. So I want to ask the panel and start with Adele, what policy tools, what culture change tools do you think are needed to actually facilitate culture change?
Well, one of the things that Commissioner Hayne talked about in his interim report and was questioned throughout the whole, you know, 12 months of hearings was greed and targets and bonuses of staff. And one of the questions he asked in the interim report is, why do you need them? You know, not everyone gets these big bonuses for doing their job. Most people get a salary and that's enough. That wasn't addressed particularly well in the Hayne final report, and to me that is the issue. That would change a lot of behaviour. Matt Comyn, the CEO of CommBank, was questioned on it in his testimony, and he gave an unnamed bank in the UK where one person he mentioned said that they were put on salaries and their productivity reduced. So he felt that you need these sort of bonuses and targets in order to get people to do their job. I'm not convinced.
So on greed, I used to have a simple, good answer for you. It was asked more in the competition context. Adam Smith, he, of course, stressed, you know, that we have to... So the challenge of economic policy is to accept that there is greed, to harness it for good uses, and to stop its misuse by making sure there is competition. Competition will discipline it. There's a lot in that, but there is a weakness that it doesn't really address the sort of stuff, the conflicts of interest and the unethical behaviour and all that kind of thing. So my old answer to your question doesn't work so well after we've heard about the banks. In fact, the more competition, maybe it makes it worse.
Another question?
Yes, going back to...
Could you please identify yourself?
Okay, Dave Anderson, just interested observer.
That'll do.
Going back to greed and culture, it seems to me, as a person out there, that banks are caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. They have two types of customers. They have the their customers who their charter says they need to provide the service at the minimal market possible so the customer gets the largest return. And they also have customers in terms of their shareholders who are about making the maximum amount of markup so that their share prices and returns are much more, much higher. I think that when you come down to the crux, they've got this all wrong. So what should they do about that? In terms of aligning the two types of customers that they've got.
So look, I'm happy to start on that because that's something that actually Commissioner Hayne talks about. A number of the witnesses stood up and said, oh, look, life's so tough for us because, like, we owe these obligations to maximise the profit of shareholders, and sometimes that might mean we sort of cut corners with customers. The Commissioner would have none of that and talked about if you take a long-term view, it's logical to think that there can be an alignment, a good quality service can also be aligned with earning acceptable profits for your shareholders. The other thing was a number of witnesses put this contrast that it was shareholder pressure that was causing the misconduct. I remember listening to, being in my office and just listening to some of this testimony and thinking, well, yeah, I'm not quite sure that's right because, in fact, the reality is, and I think the report then reflected this, it's not so much the pressure from the shareholders, it's really the financial incentives and remuneration bonuses within the firm that are the first driver of some of this conduct. And there's been a number of reports that have clearly identified the way in which a certain degree of unacceptable conduct has been clearly linked to very inappropriate financial incentives. So I don't myself think that a conflict between different stakeholders is inevitable and leads customers to suffer.
No, because you're right, because look what's happened with the Royal Commission. Share prices fell. There was reputational damage, which actually, so it was counterintuitive. You know, they were screwing customers to keep the share price up and get profits up. But that was at the expense of their reputation, which then caused their share prices to fall. You know, look at AMP, share price fell more than 50% when it was revealed the sort of corners that was being cut.
I find the concept of a social license to operate very relevant to banks, slightly less persuaded of it with other businesses. But banks have got this enormous prudential backup from governments And they, above all, are there because they get a license to operate and they get this tremendous backup. So their obligations are very great to serve the community. So I have no trouble with governments and others requiring them to look after the low-income customers, the disadvantaged ones, and so on. By whatever means, whether it's part of their culture, I'm not that confident about self-regulation working terribly well, or whether it's done by law and regulation.
Unless there's a... Yes, one last question, I'm afraid. Yeah.
Great, thank you. I can't stand up. I'm wedged in very tightly here in the back pews. Matt Foran from Senate SHJ. And thank you very much to the panel today for a really fascinating discussion. To me, there are many precedents and a long history going back probably 4,000 years of money, the pursuit of it, and the power associated with money corrupting individuals, corrupting organisations, governments, and some would even argue whole societies. So are we really that surprised by what came out of this process? And is it time for a broader discussion around what exactly a balanced scorecard might actually mean and what contribution do people make and what contribution do organisations make? And a realistic definition of language, because Adele, when you talked about, you know, productivity dropped when I removed incentives, what is actually being said is people stopped pushing the boundaries and stopped dancing over the line of what was legal and what wasn't legal in this instance in the pursuit of money. And so I'm quite interested in your views around whether or not this really requires a much, much, much broader conversation.
Look, I think it does, and that's what I was saying. I think that's where the Hayne, the final report, didn't really go into remuneration. It sort of left it to APRA, and it said that the Remuneration Committee should start looking at misconduct and compliance. Well, they do that already. And what we found is, you know, as Ian was saying, in 2016, the CEO at the time got 108% bonus when there was all these scandals going on. The board decided that was appropriate. So I think, you know, the whole balanced scorecard thing hasn't really been prosecuted properly, because the whole targets and bonuses has led to a lot of what's gone on.
Good. Okay, well, look, our time is up and lots of people need to go back to work. So on behalf of the Melbourne Press Club, a very great thanks to our panellists, Alan Fells, Adele Ferguson and Ian Ramsey. I think it's been a terrifically engaging conversation, and we appreciate your time. Thank you.
This is the Melbourne Press Club event series. Thanks to Jazz Heart from Free Music Archive for our theme music. Please give us a visit at melbournepressclub.com to find out about future speaker events.